From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all white lights,
peaches
and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Disney buys Marvel Entertainment for $4 billion. Is it a super deal or a super dud? Plus, will Hollywood's labor unions ever join forces to fight the man, or will they simply keep trying to kill each other? And finally, it's more than TV. It's more than the web. It's the total engagement experience. But first, the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by The Business producer, Matt Holzman. Matt, what's up?
Well, the big news is that Marvel Entertainment was purchased by Disney for $4 billion.
Yes, and Marvel is the company that, of course, has various comic characters such as Spider-Man, the Hulk, the X-Men, and we'll talk a little bit more about how Disney might hope to exploit those characters in a few minutes.
Well, elsewhere, a couple of weeks ago, the Academy announced that they were expanding the number of Best Picture nominees from 5 to 10. Now they've announced that they're changing the way the balloting will be conducted.
Yes, you used to make a list when you were doing nominations, but when you voted for Best Picture, you would just write down your choice for Best Picture. And now you're supposed to make a list of these 10 films in order of preference, and that will be a weighted way of determining who wins.
Basically, they're trying to prevent a situation where two great movies split the vote and a third movie ends up taking the top spot, like a kind of a Ralph Nader situation. How it will actually change the process going forward is a little unclear.
Well, I think the people I'm talking to, they are not happy with any of this. They do not like the 10 nominees. They feel it devalues the nomination and devalues the awards. I talked to a veteran campaigner who told me that he just thinks this is almost like a diabolical way of creating fake tension. And there's a lot of skepticism. And the other big point that I'm hearing from Oscar watchers is that this is a bad year, possibly partly because of the writer's strike or because of other reasons. But coming up with 10, they're scared. They're worried about how that's going to happen. And the final thing that we can say about this is a lot of people are going to have to be pressured to campaign for movies that are losers and spend money on movies that are losers. So we might be able to look forward to a lot of fighting as the producers and agents behind the loser movies press for the companies that release them to spend money on Oscar campaigns.
Well, I would only say that you make it sound like tension is a bad thing, but I think
it's good for us.
Well, it's good for Hollywood. I mean, it's the drama around the Oscars will, you know, intensify the viewership, and that is good for Hollywood. And why anyone would have a problem with that, I don't know.
I have a problem with it because I believe it will fail. I think that they will not come up with... There's no Dark Knight this year.
Okay, and I would also go on to say that...
I'm sorry, did you interrupt? I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I was going on to say that there are so many great movies out there, and the fact of the matter is this idea that you can't come up with 10. I mean, I can already come up with 10, and we're only, you know, three-quarters of the way through the year.
Yes, but the point here was to get more commercial films into the mix. Okay, we will lay our bets now. I say fail. Matt says succeed. We'll see you in, like, March. We'll talk about it.
It also depends on your definition of success or failure. Elsewhere, the future of the Weinstein Company is largely dependent on the success or failure of Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds that opened up a couple of weekends ago. So everyone is asking the question, have Harvey and Bob Weinstein been scalped, or will they live to produce another day?
Well, I'll tell you. Let's eat a little crow here. I think the movie did clearly way better than we thought it would. People find it very entertaining.
Well, wait, where's we? Who we? Did I say?
I think we both did, yeah.
I don't, Senator, I don't recall, but go ahead.
How quickly they forget.
Yes, indeed.
Anyway, it may save Quentin Tarantino. I don't know that it's big enough to save the Weinstein Company. They have a lot of big problems, but, you know, it's better than the alternative, right?
Right. I mean, it's on its way to making something like $175 million worldwide, and that is better than I think a lot of people, and including me, thought it would do. But, you know, when you take half of that and give it to the theaters, and then you take half of that and you give it to Universal, and you take a portion of that and give it to Quentin Tarantino or Brad Pitt, you know, what are they left with? Especially since the movie after marketing cost more than $100 million.
Which is why I say it's good for Quentin Tarantino. It's his best grosser ever. And, you know, a lot of directors of a certain type of film are now in the crosshairs, and he's made a commercial film, and that's good timing.
Absolutely. Well, back to the biggest story of the day, which is that Disney bought Marvel Entertainment, the home of Iron Man and Spider-Man, for $4 billion. And I wanted to talk to you more about that, Kim, because obviously you wrote a book about Disney. This is something that you know something about. And I'm just wondering if you... if it was a surprise to you, if this deal was a surprise to you.
Oh, it was a surprise to a lot of people. It was kept extremely quiet. And there's a sort of thing out there that people knew Marvel was in play. But I've talked to a lot of people who didn't and were pretty shocked. So kudos to Disney for keeping something quiet.
And is the word on the street that they think this is a good deal or...
I think the consensus is that it may not be an immediate payoff for Disney because a lot of the Marvel characters, like Spider-Man, you know, is tied up at Sony, X-Men at Fox in perpetuity. The Hulk, if you want him, was at Universal. But what Universal does have is the rights to have a lot of these characters, the existing big characters, in the theme parks, which is something that Disney, of course, would like to get.
I can't see Spider-Man at Disneyland, but I...
You know, Disney is somewhat rebranding. They're chasing boys. They've got tween girls sewn up. You know, they've got Hannah Montana. They've got Selena Gomez who, in The Wizard of Waverly Place, these girl stars that are really big. The boys, they've just launched XD, their cable channel aimed at boys. Obviously, they're pursuing boys with this. You know, the questions kind of are, people keep talking about these thousands of Marvel characters. And I talked to one analyst, Harold Vogel, who's been covering this industry for years, and he's on Wall Street. He says, you know, there's the law of nature is that only a few characters are huge, and then there's other. And you do have to, when people say there are 5,000, 7,000 Marvel characters, you say, well, what is number 6,073? Is it like Paperclip Man Dust Mote Boy? I mean, who are these characters? And if nobody's heard of them, what's the value?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Why pay $4 billion for Dust Mote Boy?
Well, the thinking is that eventually some of the stuff will revert. Disney claims that John Lasseter, the presiding genius of Pixar, has looked at these characters. Everybody got excited. So who knows? Maybe there are things in there also that Disney will discover and exploit, and it will all work. Again, the feeling is not immediately, but eventually. Longer-term thinking. What a rare concept that is. The big loser here is Viacom, perceived to be Viacom, which did the Iron Man movie with Marvel and is now seen as having kind of lost another key supplier of product.
We'll talk about some of the other winners. People are talking about DreamWorks Animation as a winner and Warner and its deal with DC Comics as a winner.
DreamWorks Animation wants to sell itself. They have a deal right now to be distributed again by Viacom. So that would be a Viacom loss again. That's Paramount's parent. And, the idea is that with Disney paying $4 billion and a deal finally being made in the entertainment world in the mid or post-recession period that we're in, maybe somebody will now say, well, I'm buying something and it's going to be DreamWorks Animation. Well, it's fraught with problems, but it could happen.
I was going to say, is it possible, you know, this is the first big, you know, merger or acquisition that has happened in Hollywood in some time. Does this signal a kind of reverse when we're going to start seeing companies getting together more in the future?
Well, I think the economy and the digital revolution all tend toward some of the herd thinning and consolidation. So we may very well see that. But, you know, we do know that Time Warner is sitting on a big pile of money, and there may be some pressure on Jeff Bukas, the head of the company, to go out there and acquire. So it could be that we're, you know, these things are sort of like fads and people start thinking they're going to buy or there's a bargain out there. So we'll see, you know, that happens. And the other big winner, of course, is the mystery mogul, the CEO of Marvel, Ike Perlmutter, who is virtually unknown in Hollywood and doesn't want to be known and pocketed the value of about $1.5 billion after he took Marvel out of bankruptcy and convinced the bankers, this was 12 years ago that he did that, to allow this company to have a life. Marvel was really headed for the scrap heap, and this guy, you know, was part of, he's apparently not a movies guy, not a comics guy, he's a business guy. They did an amazing job, and they turned this thing around, and he sold it, and he has become a billionaire.
Let me ask you this. The fanboys who make up a large part of not only the audience, but the driving force of the marketing of these movies, They didn't mind that he was a guy who, I don't think they knew who he was or had ever heard of him.
This guy is so below the radar, but almost nobody in Hollywood knows
this guy.
But
they know Disney. And if Disney is now controlling this company, do the fanboys say, I'm no longer interested, my favorite character has now been tainted by the Mickey Mouse?
I'm sure Disney will make, you know, they're saying it's going to be separate as Pixar is kept somewhat separate. They'll continue to be in Manhattan Beach away from Burbank as Pixar is, you know, in Northern California.
So,
away
what
from
are they
Burbank.
Saying? They're saying that they're going to let Marvel operate as an autonomous entity?
Marvel will be Marvel. Well, that's what they're saying. There's some skepticism about how true that is, but that's absolutely what they're saying and what they need to say. And, you know, I've talked to people about stuff like this and who are used to doing these kinds of movies, and they say the fanboys always complain about everything, and then they're the first ones in line to buy the tickets.
Worst episode ever.
Yes, I hated it 17 times. So that's, you know, I think they'll watch and they'll blog and they'll, you know, do what they do, but I would expect Disney to play its cards pretty smartly on this one.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait for the opening of Paperclip Boy coming to, or Paperclip Man?
It could be Paperclip Girl. I don't know, woman. I don't have no clue.
That's the sequel.
Yeah.
Coming to a theater near you.
Yes. And that's all the news that's fit to banter about, and then some. Coming up next, the drama continues with Hollywood's labor unions. A few months ago, the town heaved a sigh of relief when the Screen Actors Guild finally made a deal with the studios. Rancor and infighting had slowed down film production for more than 6 months. SAG couldn't exactly call the deal a victory, but they did get one juicy thing out of it. The three key Hollywood guilds, writers, directors, actors, now have their contracts synced up. So next time, when their deals expire in 2011, they can threaten to walk out together. That is, if they can present a united front. But SAG's internal strife continues to be almost comical, and there's internal fighting at the Writers Guild as well. So we've brought back our regular labor correspondent, Jonathan Handel. He's of counsel with Troy Gould, and he's an adjunct professor at the UCLA School of Law. He also blogs about Hollywood's labor wars. So where are things with SAG at this point?
Well, we're in the middle of the SAG election cycle, and it's a controversial time. All of the dissent and disagreement that resulted in a one-year SAG stalemate has come back to roost, and the hardliners, the so-called membership first group, are very opposed and continue to be opposed to the agreement that was struck on TV and the theatrical. And meanwhile, the more moderate group, the Unite for Strength group, defends that agreement. The other big source of controversy is the question of whether to merge with AFTRA, the smaller performers' union, and that's a real flashpoint as well.
So are there key candidates that have emerged now in the SAG election?
Yes. Anne-Marie Johnson is running on the membership first ticket and running for president, and she is the current vice president and has been involved with the opposition to the existing agreement and all of the sort of political wars that have gone on.
So she'd be sort of the de facto successor to Alan Rosenberg.
She would be the de facto successor to Alan Rosenberg, more polished, more presentable, a woman, a person of color, both of those things are likely to make some difference, and a name that's known. On the Unite for Strength side, the candidate is Ken Howard, who also is a known...
The white shadow.
Quantity. The white shadow, exactly. Exactly. And he is sort of a sober presence and someone who favors getting things done in terms of closing agreements. The wild card is Seymour Cassell, who is more hardline, more membership first in some ways than Anne-Marie Johnson. And he really wants to throw a lot of the bums out and is running for president as well. He's likely to take votes away from Anne-Marie, and that may make the difference.
Now, just give us a time frame. The election is when?
Well, the ballots went out a few days ago, and they're due back by the end of September, the 24th or so. And at that point, they'll be tallied within a few hours, and we'll know the results.
Clearly, if either Anne-Marie Johnson or less likely, I guess, the Seymour Cassell wins, there's going to be a lot more rancor and contention, I suppose, as opposed to Ken Howard?
There's going to be more rancor and contention, and... depending on how the board elections shake out, you may continue to have split control, it's likely that the board elections will favor the moderate Unite for Strength side and their New York and regional allies, simply because the people that are up in L.A. for election are all membership first.
I'm going to take a leap and guess that Ken Howard is going to win this election, even though I have no reason for doing that other than intuition. But if he does win, is there a likely merger with AFTRA coming up?
Well, that's a real question mark. After two attempts in the last 10 years or so, and all of the rancor on the part of membership first, the opposition to AFTRA, to the AFTRA deal last year, and the bad-mouthing of AFTRA, AFTRA says it's had enough. They really are waiting to see a very different tone from SAG before they'd even consider merger. They also say, you know what, it's all or nothing. You either take all of our actors, but also our broadcasters, or else we're not interested in a merger, and it would be a merger of equals.
So with all the fighting going on, it seems that a union merger is down the road, if ever.
A union merger is down the road, if ever, and that's something that has got to be pleasurable to management, because it means that in the upcoming negotiations, which will start at the end of 2010, the contract expires middle 2011, once again, management may be able to play the two unions off against each other.
Oh, that would be like a rerun of a bad story.
It would be a rerun of a bad story, and indeed, if Anne-Marie Johnson, the hardline membership first, is elected, the industry really fears a degree of confrontation and an increased likelihood of a strike again in a year and a half or so.
Sure. I mean, are you liking my Ken Howard prediction, or are you going to be cautious and sit on the sidelines?
I think Ken Howard probably has it, particularly because you're going to see the membership first vote split between the two candidates on that side of the table.
Two more confrontational candidates. Okay, now moving to the Writers Guild, where are we?
Well, we have an unusually contentious election with the Writers Guild as well. Their ballots also went out. They're due back towards the end of September. And the Writers Guild candidates include one candidate, Elias Davis, who is aligned with the previous leadership that took the Guild out on strike, versus John Wells, who was a previous leader of the Guild and favors a more moderate approach.
Of course, he was the producer of ER and a lot of television shows, a very well-known producer and writer.
That's right. And he favors, just sort of like Ken Howard on the SAG side, more of an engagement with the producers and studios, more of an attempt to get a deal done without another strike, certainly.
And there have been extraordinarily ugly allegations back and forth that John Wells was sold out the Writers Guild in this last negotiation by making back channel deals with the Directors Guild, as I understand it. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, it really is sort of like the white Russians versus the red Russians versus the blue Russians. And that's true both in the Writers Guild and SAG. The degree of internal politics here is kind of amazing, and it's become increasingly a factor in the industry's perception of Hollywood unions and the industry's concern about where things are going.
So basically, we're looking at really big picture. We're talking about factions that really want to attack largely on the subject of how they are compensated for new media, among other issues, and people who are feeling that with the economy changing, with technology causing a big revolution, with so much uncertainty in the industry, it's best to be conciliatory and make a deal and keep working. Is that a fair summary?
Well, that's exactly right. And you've got these extremely different strategies for engaging with management. One side says, you know what, let's make a deal. This is a business issue. The other side says, take a hard line. Hollywood's a union town.
We'll be back in a minute with more about Hollywood and its labor pains with Jonathan Handel. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. We'd love to know what you think. Write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking about Hollywood's seemingly endless labor pains with lawyer and blogger Jonathan Handel. If the Ken Howard and John Wells factions are elected, is there still a possibility, you think, that they will align and fight a hard fight for this new media compensation come 2010?
Well, there is. I mean, no one on the SAG side really was terribly happy with the deal. It was a question of getting a deal done and recognizing the realistic lack of leverage because of, in part, of where Membership First had taken the Guild, or continuing to engage in a stalemate. But there are real gaps in coverage and residuals and so forth in the new media deal. So to some extent, there were some chickens that were deferred till the next round of negotiations, and they're going to come home to roost.
Now, this is the time when they're synced up on when their membership, when their contracts lapse, and they could walk out together, and it could really, really hurt even worse than the writer's strike did.
We could see a simultaneous strike, and if the guilds get their act together, we're certainly going to see potentially a simultaneous coordinated negotiating strategy.
If. What do you think the odds are?
I'm not a betting fool when it comes to that. You know, there's really a lot of dispute and disagreement amongst the guilds. The Directors Guild, for its part, basically has never struck once in their 70-some-odd year history. The IA really doesn't strike in
that's
circumstances
the crews
like this.
And the below-the-line people. Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's the crew and below-the-line people.
Well, they never seem to get into sync with the actors and the writers and the directors, so...
You know, the big picture here also is that Hollywood, of course, is locked in a struggle with Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is not a union town, not a union county or region. And that creates a very different profile in terms of the agility and speed with which companies up there can change their business strategies. Not so much down here.
Yeah, so that could be an issue as everything changes thanks to the technological revolution, the digital revolution.
We are in for, unfortunately, a period probably of a decade or so of difficult labor relations in Hollywood because, of course, Silicon Valley doesn't take an Ambien and stop innovating. There'll continue to be new challenges when it comes to technology.
Yes, there will. Well, thank you so much. Jonathan Handel is an entertainment attorney at Troy Gould and an adjunct professor, law professor at UCLA. Thank you so much for talking to us.
That's my pleasure.
Last week, we talked to Ian Sander and Kim Moses, the producers of the CBS series Ghost Whisperer, about how they work together as a married couple in show business. We also chatted with them about what they call the total engagement experience, a sweeping approach to bringing entertainment and products to a wide range of platforms. Sander told us they started building this model when CBS picked up Ghost Whisperer.
When we started on Ghost Whisperer, before we went on the air, we knew we were going to be a Friday night show. 8 o'clock on CBS, a Friday night show.
Which is not a great slot.
Which is not a great slot. We did our research, and we found that 18% of shows that had premiered in the last 10 years on a Friday night have gone year two. Hence, do the math, 82% hadn't. And we were on a network that this was a very different show. I mean, I have to hand it to them that they took a shot with us. It was very different than most of the shows that were on the network at that time. And we knew we had to do something to try and support that. I've done 8 one-hour dramas, and Kim and I have done 6 of those together. And it used to be that you would say, okay, I'm going to produce the show and let them sell it, them being the networks in the studio, let them sell it. And then you would complain that they didn't sell it enough. And we've done that, been there, done that. And this time we said, no, you know what? Part of our job is also to help deliver that audience. So let's go get that audience where they are. And we knew about the internet. We had been working on the internet actually separate from television for 10 years, going back to when we did Profiler, going back to the late 90s, which was really early. And we have children that were right in the pocket. We had a son that was right in the pocket, and we knew that if he watched television, there was a laptop on his lap. And we said, you know what? That's where they are. So we started a buzz on the internet prior to the show even getting on the air, so that by the time Ghost Whisperer premiered in September, we were, I don't know, I think it was measured by Trendums or something. We were the most anticipated show coming on.
Wow.
Where the year before it had been lost, the show lost. And we had Jennifer Love Hewitt, who was clearly a very downloadable star. And so we started then. And eventually that ultimately led to webisodes, which won awards. We went to Comic-Con and we did a graphic novel online that led to IDW publishing I think we have 10 or 12 comic books out there now, and that led to novels and novelizations, and then Kim and I wrote a companion book, so we were in publishing. We did music videos that we put online with Mary J. Blige, who was a star of one of our episodes.
You also are selling things, merchandise?
Our show has a store in the show, which is the same as it never was, Antique Store, which are antiques with a contemporary twist, and our character, Melinda Gordon, runs that antique store.
That's Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Right.
And so what we've done is we have gone out and made relationships with artists who create things like haunted collector's teacups and the beautiful locket that was in season 3 that was haunted that was given to Melinda by her then stepbrother. So when you go online to CBS's CNN website, you can buy those things from the Same As It Never Was antique store, and they actually come wrapped like our actors wrap them in the TV show. It's pushing out to give the audience an experience.
Things freestanding revenue generators? Or
all of these things bring in money. When we did talk about revenue, I mean, all of these things, whether it's the comic books, this year we're coming out with a video game, which will come out probably right after we have our 100th episode, which Jennifer Love Hewitt is directing, all of which do create revenue. Well, when we did the webisodes for Ghost Whisperer, we came up with an idea. It came from, we had gotten a lot of emails as to, we know what it's like to be a ghost whisperer. We watched the show, but what's it like to be a ghost? So we came up with the idea of having a web series from the point of view of the ghost. And we called it The Other Side. We pitched it to CBS sales, and they said, can you put a car in it? Which is like asking an actor, can you ride a horse? The answer is always yes.
Right.
So we pitched it to General Motors. They paid for the web series. The web series did really well. It won, TVGuide.com gave it Best Web Series of the Year. And we're now getting ready to do our fourth installment of The Other Side. They then...
I thought NBC was reinventing television, but here you guys are.
No, they then, after doing that, they then signed on to sponsor the television series, which they currently do, which obviously creates revenue for the network. And we also, for the studios, revenue was created by having our regulars in the show now drive GM cars. They paid the studio some money to do that. So all of that goes into the budget of the show. And as everybody's talking about, advertising is going away. If you find a way to incorporate those kinds of things into your show and have it not take away creatively from the show, or find ways to integrate it in a seamless way where it really is not a creative drag on the show, those are the kinds of things that I think producers obviously have to do so that we can maintain the quality of the shows.
We write and produce The Other Side, and the purpose in doing all these different platforms, including The Other Side, is so that the audience can experience the Ghost Whisperer world for themselves, because we think the days are gone where people just want to have a flat experience where they're watching just what Melinda Gordon's doing. They want to watch it, learn from it, and experience it themselves. And on these platforms, that's what you get to do with the total engagement experience.
Ian Sander and Kim Moses are TV producers, writers, directors, and a married couple in Hollywood. They are executive producers of, among other things, the CBS drama Ghost Whisperer. And thank you guys so much for coming in.
Our pleasure.
It's been wonderful.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is our associate producer. Our theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.